Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody, welcome to our show. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Maybe you've decided to stay home for the holidays, avoid the airports, highway traffic, save some money, just enjoy the city. But your clever plan comes with some pitfalls. Now, out-of-town friends and family who've always wanted to see New York know you're home, and they've hired you as their holiday tour guide. So where do you take them? When they want to go to the most fabulous meal, the most authentic Italian restaurant, or they want to go to Times Square? Well, we hear you out there. Help's on the way. Eater New York has compiled the ultimate visitor's guide to eating in New York City, and we have a few of the contributors in studio now. Robert Sestima, he is the restaurant critic at Eater. Stephanie Tudor, senior editor at Eater New York, and Ryan Sutton, chief food critic at Eater. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you.
Okay, listeners, we do want to hear from you. If you have a favorite restaurant, a place where you take visitors, will you please tell us your secret spot? We want to know. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Okay, so Eater published its list of 38 essential restaurants in the city. What makes a restaurant essential?
Well, number one, it has to be actually delicious.
Just not hype?
Just not hype. I mean, I think we would all agree that we've had some pretty bad meals in New York City. Right, guys?
Never.
Never. But, you know, of course, you know, to the point of, you know, what makes a restaurant essential, I think, you know, in the Eater voice, we like to think of restaurants that probably one couldn't encounter outside of New York. You know, we can, there are great French brasseries, you know, around this our fine fruited plain. But, you know, when you think of a place like, I don't know, Hometown Barbecue, which, you know, amalgamates all the great smoked meat traditions of New York.
Yeah, but that's a bad example because Texas beats the pants off of New York barbecue-wise.
It says someone from
Texas. But that's
Texas.
Exactly why you couldn't find Hometown Barbecue in Texas. You could only find it in New York City.
Right, that's because celebrates, you know, smoked meat traditions like, you know, a Caribbean jerk. Has, you know, Italian sausages. You know, as the old saying goes, you know, you have three food critics, you have six opinions. And so we're going to disagree a little bit here.
Well, it's interesting because I was reading that restaurants come and go on this list out of sort of relevance. What makes a restaurant relevant in 2018? What do you think, Robert?
Oh, my God. Well, for one thing, we're really pushing hard to get a lot more people of color and women who run restaurants who are still in a small minority. It's amazing how little the Chef's Club has changed, even in spite of the Me Too movement. It's still usually white men that are chefs in restaurants, and fighting to get other voices and other talents in there is a main priority. But in doing so, you know, we're kind of going far and wide and looking in the other boroughs. There's so many restaurants that don't have publicists where there are people that are like cooking their asses off and doing an amazing job, often of cuisines that are kind of unfamiliar to the dining public. So, you know, we're trying to work to get those places included.
That's great. So out of this list, I'm going to ask you each for two favorites from the list. You want to go first, Ryan?
Sure. From the which list?
The essential restaurants in New York.
Oh, gosh.
Or two of your favorites.
Well, two of my favorite restaurants, if I had to send someone anywhere throughout the city, I tend to be preferential sometimes towards Kings County. I really like a restaurant called La Vara in Carroll Gardens, just south of Atlantic Avenue, run by Alex Vara and Eder Montero, probably two of the city's best Iberian chefs. What's interesting about this, again, there is no shortage of Spanish restaurants in New York City. This one does things a little bit differently. It tips its hat to the Sephardic and Moorish traditions of Spain. And so you have food influenced by both the Muslim and Jewish traditions of the Iberian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And they serve some really tasty food, you know, a slow-cooked lamb breast with a little bit of harissa sauce, or chicken, you know, with a kind of Moorish-style spices. A really tasty food. And again, the other one I would recommend, if I had to pick a second restaurant that I really loved in New York, I'm a real fan of these days. I don't know if it's on the E or 38, but of Guantanamera. It's an old-school Cuban restaurant in Hell's Kitchen. I believe it's been open for the better part of a decade, which really...
It's on Ryan's personal 38.
Your personal 38?
It's awful.
It doesn't hurt that I live just a block away, but I think what's great about the restaurant is that it's free live music every night. There's no cover charge. Really amazing Cuban food. One of the city's best vaca fritas, which is just essentially skirt steak pan-fried in the Cuban style, and you can listen to it again as, you know, a four-piece band, including a jazz food player, just hums away from usually 11 o'clock on. So really tasty food.
All right, Stephanie, your list, your two.
All right, I'm going to give you CN Famous Foods, which is a homegrown chain.
I was going to do that.
Great.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
I can switch to Mala Project.
No, that's good. That's good.
Well, so CN Famous Foods, it started as a stall in Flushing.
Will you spell it?
X-I-A-N.
Thank you.
And it started as a stall in Flushing, and this father-son team, the father's recipes, the son went to business school and kind of brought it into sort of the modern business era, and
they cloned the hell out of it.
They now have, I believe it's 14 locations across New York City, and everything is under $20. There's all hand-pulled noodles, so every time you walk into a store, they're stretching and ripping the dough, and it's slapping on the counter, and then they're boiling it and mixing it with this really heady blend of spices that is spicy and fragrant and salty and truly decadent. They're famous for their cumin lamb noodles, so there's a ton of cumin, lamb pieces throughout, and it's just something I crave every day.
And they also have like lamb face salad. I mean, they don't censor the food
for
a broader audience.
And I think that they've really introduced that cuisine to a much wider amount of people and thus became, essential just by being really excellent. Another place I would choose, and maybe this would also be a Robert place, so sorry, Robert, is Via Carota, which is an Italian restaurant in the West Village. It's run by two partners in business and in life, Jody Williams and Rita Sodi, and it's just a really charming little cafe right off of the Christopher Street stop on the One. And they have pastas and they have vegetables that change all the time. They have, it's just, you go in there and you feel like you're in New York, and it's walk-in only, so anyone can get in every day.
Like that.
Expect a wait, though. Really, really nice wine selection. They have a Lambrusco, which is kind of hard to find sometimes in New York City. And I love to take visitors there. I really do. I think it kind of gives them a really charming view of what people picture New York to be.
I like to take them to better Italian restaurants.
Okay. Well, Ryan is more of a fan of Isodi, which is the Rita Sodi's restaurant just very nearby.
She was once a Levi's executive in San Francisco before she became a chef. She grew up in
what a fun fact.
Near Florence on a farm.
You know, we've got some good callers. Let's take Andrew from Brooklyn. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, how are you guys?
Good. Where do you like to take your guests? What's your favorite these days?
You should take them on an adventure on the Staten Island Ferry, go to the North Shore, and go to New Asha for extremely authentic Sri Lankan food.
I love that place.
Ah!
Oh, so good.
You hit a nerve.
There.
Across the street from the Albanian mosque, which is why it's there.
Yes, and a great little soccer shop as well.
Yeah.
And since there are so many vegans out there, including myself, go to Williamsburg to Champ Steiner and get vegan pancakes.
Wow.
Andrew.
Good one. I haven't been there.
You know, your restaurants.
Check it out.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amanda in Greenpoint. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going forward. How about you?
Good. So my favorite place is Corner Deli, but it's spelled D-E-H-L-I. And it's a place
in Park Slope.
Yeah, exactly. It's over on Bergen Street. And what's great about it is that it's like Anglo-Indian mix. So if you have friends or family who are coming from out of town and they're a little bit worried about spices, they have like a steak and a salmon dish. But then they also have a sog paneer and some amazing, amazing flavors. Tark, the owner, is such a sweetheart, and he's taken so much time to make sure like the ingredients are fresh and gluten-free at times and vegetarian. It's just like the cocktails and the wine list. It's one of my favorite places of all time to go.
Amanda, thank you for sharing it. If you want to get in on the conversation, the number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to share the place you take out of towners, we're talking to Robert, Stephanie, and Ryan, all from Eater. So Robert, Chelsea Market, it's been around. I remember when it opened.
It was so good.
It was so sweet
and nobody
interesting,
was there.
And there was texture to it. And it was the biscuit company and all that. And now I'm a little scared when I go in there.
Well, you should be.
Because you're dodging tourists.
It's suffocating.
It's a little bit tough, but I know there's great food in there. So your people coming out of town are going to want to go to Chelsea Market. They just want to go now. Can you guide us through two or three places that we can go to and not feel terrified.
Sure. There's the there's Miznan, which is conveniently located on the west side, in other words, from the 10th Avenue entrance, which is less populated. And you can kind of dart in that entrance and go right into Miznan pretty quickly. It's an Israeli chain that does these pita sandwiches, but it doesn't use those horrible cardboard pitas. It uses homemade pitas, which are kind of big and puffy and starchy, and slits them in the middle and puts like 25 different fillings that vary by the day. They change their menu every day, but one of the best things that they make is called the folded cheeseburger, which is a thin patty that's seared so that it has like all this beefy flavor and with a piece of cheddar cheese and like some pickle sticking out of the top of it. And it's all in a pita and it's just out of this world. It's just fantastic.
Robert, you also like Los Tacos there, don't you?
Well, Los Tacos is one of the premier, against all odds, one of the premier taquerias in the city.
That's the one I go to. That's when I have to go to, when I take somebody to Chelsea Market, that's the way we go.
So wonderful. I'm afraid that it might prevent people from going out to Sunset Park or going to Corona or someplace or East Harlem where there are, you know, kind of more indigenous style taquerias that come from Mexican immigrants. But this Los Tacos number one is kind of like modeled on a beach shack in the Baja Peninsula and just makes fantastic tacos in a very small selection and people line up. That and Miznan are a couple of the best places. But there's in my list, you know, which is in that guide, there are, you know, probably 20 places altogether. I don't remember how many I did.
But you did 10.
10. Okay, yeah. 10. I always exaggerate.
And of course, the trick is if the line is too long in Chelsea, not that you would necessarily go to Times Square, but if you happen to be in Times Square, the wait is shorter at the second location of Los Tacos, which I think is a good trick.
In the old New York Times building.
In the old New York Times building, and there's never a shortage of people in Times Square, of course, and never a shortage of tourists.
Yeah.
That is very funny. Thank you so much. I have like a reimagining of my Chelsea Market experience. You have friends who come into town and say, can we go get Italian food in Little Italy? And then you kind of decide, no, let's go someplace else. Red Sauce Joints.
Oh, my God.
Where should we go?
I think New York is really, like, that's something that when I think of tourists coming to New York or when I think of New York, I just think it's so embedded in the culture here is Red Sauce Italian.
Well, a lot of the Red Sauce Italian, like the meatball, was actually invented in Brooklyn. It was invented by Italian housewives who came here as immigrants and who just didn't find any of the Southern Italian ingredients. There was no goat. There was no lamb. There were, you know, they just didn't have the stuff. So they substituted American stuff, you know, from the German butcher shops. They found giant wads of ground beef. And what the hell do you do with ground beef? So they just rolled it into a ball and the meatball was born. So this cuisine, I mean, the best place to find it is to go back to Brooklyn and go to a place like Frost Restaurant, a little known place in Williamsburg where they just, the food is just, it makes you cry. It's so good. It
has I would say if your friends want to go to Little Italy, do your best and divert them to Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. That's
right.
Where do you like to go, Stephanie? What would you suggest as a red sauce place?
Very near to Frost is Bemonti's.
And that's every bit as good, but a little more touristy.
A little more touristy, but I think, you know, tourists like to be a little touristy. And so,
of course, and who can blame them?
And who can blame them? And so I think it's kind of like a really lovely experience to take them. And it has all the classics on the menu, and you feel really good in there. It feels old, and that's what you want it to feel like.
I have two words, baked pastas. Get the, you know, get the baked macaroni, get the lasagna, get the baked ravioli. It's all fantastic, filled with fresh ricotta cheese.
Or if I can have a slightly contrarian opinion on the subject of Red Sauce Fare, I know both of you will probably disagree. I think Carbone by the Major Food Group, which has a Michelin star.
And will cost you an arm and a leg.
It will certainly cost you an arm and a leg. I think the veal marsala is about probably $65 to $70. One of the best veal marsalas you'll ever have. It's a full chop coated in a really intense mushroom glaze. Of course, there's a few Carbones around the world right now. There's one in Hong Kong, and there's one in Las Vegas that, you know, kind of tips its hat to the Rat Pack culture. But I think it really also, it's an homage to the Red Sauce Fare of New York in kind of a fancified, nostalgic way. And of course, we also have Don Angie, in the West Village or in Greenwich Village, which serves really amazing updated red sauce fare. And they kind of use the framework of Italian-American cooking kind of, you know, as a loose guide rather than a set of culinary handcuffs. So you don't necessarily have the same, you know, meatballs and spaghetti as the other red sauce places, but you have like newer things like, I don't know, caramelle pasta with, you know, cantaloupe sauce that's been pickled. So would,
oh,
most,
that
people,
sounds awful.
Would most people identify it as Italian-American or red sauce? Probably not. But if we're going to take that style of cuisine into the future, I think it needs to be allowed to advance.
There's lasagna on that menu. There's Caesar salad on the menu. But the Caesar salad, rather than coming with, you know, dreaded romaine, is with chrysanthemum leaves. And so it's just, it's kind of updates that like that that are very novel. And I think I would say, argue perhaps don't take a visitor there, but a New Yorker should check it out.
Well, you could go to John's of Bleecker Street, too, if you want to go to an old historic place that has not only pastas, but some of the best pizza in the city.
Dominique online, too, from the Bronx, says she has where we have to go for Italian, right? Dominique, where do we go? Line two? Maybe she'll be there? Dominique!
Hello, am I on?
You are. Where are we going?
Hi, we're going to the Bronx. And with all due respect to Monty's in Brooklyn, because my father did grow up with Jimmy Montemorano and he has been a guest at our home, I have to say, being a resident of the Bronx for 10 years, that Arthur Avenue is really an underexplored gem for New Yorkers as well as out-of-town guests. My favorite are two owned by a man from Naples called Roberto's, which has amazing homemade baked pastas, as well as Cero Otto Nove, which is the area code of Naples.
Owned by the same guy, yeah.
Owned by the same guy, and he has the same sort of pasta as well as amazing pizza there, including Nutella pizza, which is amazing for dessert. So, and it's just a great neighborhood to take out of towners because there's the Arthur Avenue market that you can go into, and this time of year it's all done up for Christmas, and it's much more, I feel, sort of an authentic Italian American neighborhood than say Little Italy in Manhattan.
Dominique, thanks so much. On line three we have Guido from Manhattan. Hi Guido.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Where are we going? Where are you taking us?
Well, I think the best Italian-American restaurant around is Molino. And it's more about the atmosphere. I think, actually, all the restaurants, if you're taking somebody from out of town, it's more about the overall atmosphere of the place rather than just the food. For example, Katz, you might not get the greatest pastrami sandwich at Katz, but
man, disagree
nothing,
with you.
Me too.
No, nope, I'm with you, brother. Much better at Second Avenue Deli.
There's nothing in the world like taking, I have people from out of town all the time. Taking them to Katz is mind-blowing. I had Spanish guests in town last week. There's no way as good as any Spanish restaurant might be in Brooklyn or anywhere that I'm going to take Spanish guests to a Spanish restaurant in Brooklyn. I mean, that's just insane. Also,
well, there aren't any, for one thing.
Well, there is a few around. Socarrat isn't bad for rice, but the other one is Peter Luger's. You're not going to Peter Luger's because it's the best steak anymore, but you're going to Peter Luger's because that's the place to go.
You're all about atmosphere, Guido. It sounds like you're all about the classics.
I mean, it's a pretty decent steak there, and the pastrami sandwich, you can't really beat. Well, pastrami queen's pretty good on 77th.
I agree there. That's good, but
Guido, thanks.
Katz's is better.
Thanks so much. We're talking to Robert, Stephanie, and Ryan, all from Eater. So I tease this: what if people just say, "I want a good Times Square"? Where can you take
We some? Can help.
Please help. Please help, because I've had that situation.
So we were talking about this when we were creating this guide because, I mean, who the hell wants to go to Times Square?
Who lives here anyway?
Yeah, exactly. And so we turned to Robert, our dear Robert, who he's always the guy to go to for when you want to find the sort of more off the beaten path and not as publicized gems. And so we asked him to create a guide to where New Yorkers actually eat in Times Square, and he did not disappoint.
Why, thank you. For one thing, there's Margon, which is just in the east of the Times Square, maybe just half a block away. And it's an old Cuban restaurant that is dating to the 1960s, in the days when Cuban was really big around Times Square, and when New York City had a big Cuban population. So they had, the only vestige remaining is the Copacabana. But this is a place where you can go in, and every day the menu changes on a weekly basis. They have wonderful pernil. They have Cuban sandwiches. They have fricasseed chicken. They have octopus salad. They have cod salad. All the old favorites, and just rendered magnificently. In most things, a big steaming plate of food is going to cost you less than $10. And wow. Here you're in Times Square, but the place is so unprepossessing looking that nobody...
It breaks my heart that places like that exist, and then, you know, Applebee's is full.
It's kind of tough, yeah. That's a tough one. So, Ryan, let's say I want to splurge. I want to break a window. You know, you get the check and you say, who broke a window? Where are some great places to splurge to take your guests?
You can spend a lot of money in New York City. And I'd like to stress, of course, that, you know, a splurge can be, for some people, a $100 dinner for two, which I like, which is why I like to think a place like Hometown Barbecue, which I was talking about before, can be a great splurge for, you know, a great special occasion, for a birthday party. If one wanted to drop a little bit more money, I think Le Bernardin in the Theater District, which is I like to think of as technically in the larger Times Square District, is probably the best place to eat seafood in our great city. It's Eric Ripert, a friend of the late Anthony Bourdain, serves a four-course seafood menu for about $160. Yes, that's a lot of money, which means, you know, dinner for two after tax and tip is probably going to cost you somewhere in the ballpark of $500. Now, if you
want
to
break a window money,
that is break a window. But that's break a window money. If you want a whole paycheck or a whole rent check restaurant, I can do that for you too. And I would recommend the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair in my native Hell's Kitchen, where dinner is probably going to cost you about $1,000 for two. It's
I throw my head back and laugh.
Three Michelin starred restaurants.
Who is in these places?
Sometimes bankers, but it's not just rich people. Sometimes it's just, you know, everyday folks who save up their money. And, you know, just as one would spend, say, $1,000 for tickets for good seats at Hamilton, it's not an entirely dissimilar price at some of these fancy restaurants. And dinner lasts just as long, and hopefully it will intellectually stimulate you and satisfy you in the same way that good theater or art or even sports
might do so. Will I walk away from Chef's Table hungry, Ryan?
No, you won't, but I would argue that sometimes that's good, because just as, you know, sometimes after you go see the opera, you just want to go home and watch The Hunt for Red October or something kind of level-headed. Sometimes after a 30-course tasting menu of, like, little hors d'oeuvre bites...
You go to Shake Shack?
You go to Shake Shack, because you just want a regular hamburger to bring things back down to reality, and that's what's great about New York. You can get both.
Let's take a couple calls. Jake on line 5 has a suggestion for Times Square. Hi, Jake.
Hi. So not exactly in Times Square, but near enough that you can just walk there quickly, and especially when people are going to theater and they're like, where should I eat before? I really like Pure Thai Cookhouse on 9th Avenue.
That's quite a good place,
Yeah, and it satisfies a couple things that I like for out-of-towners, which is it's in a place where a lot of people want to go, like, you know, that midtown area that nobody really wants to go to. And it also is like Thai food that you can't really get in most parts of America. It's not like pad Thai and, you know, satay and sort of the standard Thai American dishes. There's a lot of flavors and sort of sour flavors and tart flavors that you aren't used to getting. It's really small and you're really close to people, which is also kind of New York-y. The food is just phenomenal. And they do like a braised brisket bao, like a bun that is out of this world. And then they have a crab and pork noodle that has just a tiny little bit of sauce at the bottom of it. It's not like a soup, but just a little sauce at the bottom of the bowl. And that is just a phenomenal noodle dish.
All right. Thank you so much. We have a question. We're going to squeeze in one more call because it's a question. Vincent is calling from Riverdale and he wants some advice. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you looking for?
What I would love to know if there are any ramen aficionados among you.
Oh, yes.
I have made a custom of taking people who are out of town to Ipudu. So I'm wondering if you feel that Ipudu is overrated, as there is that, you know, I have the word on the street is that it might be. I still enjoy the place. But I've made a very slow and steady tour of Manhattan and Brooklyn trying to hit as many ramen places as possible. So one, I would love to know if you all have like your favorite spot, the one that you think hands down is the best, that maybe is better than Ipudu.
Have you tried Tabaka behind the Port Authority on 9th Avenue?
No, I don't think so.
It's a good one, and it's a little bit cheaper. Ipudu is great, but it's not worth the trouble to get in there.
Yeah, it's a chain. It's really, you know, you can have to wait a lot to get inside. Not too far away from Ipudu in Hell's Kitchen, there's a place called Toto Ramen. Sometimes there's a line there, too. But the reason I think you might like that is that while Ipudu serves pork tonkatsu, Toto Ramen serves a chicken Paitan ramen, which is very similar. It's just as fatty, but it uses, you know, fatty chicken broth instead of pork broth. Really tasty, cash only. If you're lucky, you can get in and out in about 30 minutes, and I think that's a worthwhile alternative. And also, there's not a whole lot of them where there's a ton of Ipudos.
And I'd like to throw one in a little further downtown in the West Village, which is another style to try that's not tonkatsu, which is Ieke, which is really not very common in New York City. And it's, you can get various types of broth, but what makes this different is thicker noodles. And I personally like to have like a nice chew in my soup like that. So it's called EAK Ramen. They named it that so you would know how to pronounce the soup style.
And we have an eater's guide to ramen that has probably 25 places on it, but ramen places are opening up so fast that that you can't even keep track of them.
But when in doubt, I'd say walk around Hell's Kitchen, which is more or less kind of the unofficial ramen district of New York in addition to the East Village.
Before I let you go, is there any restaurant that falls in a touristy area that we didn't get to that you think's important for people to know? Times Square,
you stumped us.
Down all the way downtown by Statue of Liberty.
I would say Charles's Soul Food Kitchen up in Harlem is just an absolutely fantastic fried chicken place. It began as a truck 30 years ago in Harlem, and now it's still there with a kind of fancier build out, and but still cheap as hell, and with amazing fried chicken, some of the best in the city.
And I'd say in Times Square, the Theater District, definitely try the new Mala Project, dry style of Sichuan meat pots, really tasty, and it's indicative of the new style of Chinese food that's kind of sweeping Manhattan. Lots of young operators, often NYU graduates, who are trying to serve the food of their homeland that you really can't find a whole lot here right now. So Mala Project in Midtown, really tasty food, kind of not too far from Times Square. You can get in and out for under $20. Super tasty.
I would add to that that we didn't really touch on, like, pizza very much.
Oh, you don't want to go there with our we get a whole 40 minutes on pizza.
Yeah, okay.
You can.
Like, pizza, steak, and bagels, and that kind of, like, iconic New York food. We have a ton of places on the guide that will lead you to wherever you go that's nearest you at the moment. And, I mean, New York and pizza, it's everywhere, but is it all really that good? But we can take you to the good places.
Stephanie Tudor, Ryan Sutton, and Robert Tetsuma. From Eater, you guys, thank you so much for all your advice. I hope you guys will come back.
Thanks for having us on.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be back with Clemency Burton Hill in just a moment. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. It's Monday afternoon, which means it's time on All of It when we check in with our regular contributor and friend of the show, Clemency Burton Hill. She is WNYC's Creative Director for Music and Arts, and she kindly stops by each week to play us some classical music tracks that made it into her book, Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. And it's about the right size to fit into a stocking. It'd be an excellent stocking stuffer, if I do say so myself. We have a variety this week. We're going to get in the holiday spirit, though, right, Clemency?
We are, absolutely. And apologies if you can hear my stomach grumbling after that wonderful segment that
honestly,
we just had. Amazing. We're going to start with a piece called The Lamb, but it has got nothing to do with eating lambs, obviously. Boom. Sorry about that. That was not intentional. We're going to start with a piece that I've put aside for the 18th of December. So technically tomorrow's entry in the book. And it's by a composer called John Taverner, who died in 2013. He was a very, very prominent figure in British musical life. He wrote things like The Song for Athene, which was heard at the funeral of Diana, Princess of of Wales. He also wrote an astonishing piece called The Protecting Veil, which won the Mercury Prize. And he occupied a really interesting place because so often classical composers are not seen as part of cultural life, everyday mainstream life, which is one of the things that I personally feel like I'm on a mission to change. But John Taverner did have a lot of popularity, and particularly at this time of year, this beautiful setting of words by William Blake often makes it onto Christmas compilations, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's an incredibly serene and gorgeous piece. And I should point out that he wrote this in a single afternoon. What do you get done in an afternoon?
Not as much as that.
Not as much as that. You're a pretty high-achieving human, Alison Stewart.
And I work a lot, but not as much as that.
I know. There's something, I think, what a divinely inspired afternoon that must have been. And I love the fact that he wrote it for his little nephew, who was 3 at the time. And it's based on just 7 notes. It's perfect.
I love the warmth when the deeper voices come in.
I know, isn't that magical at that moment? He was talking about the fact that this had really captured hearts around the globe because it had such huge popularity. And he said Blake's childlike vision perhaps explains the Lamb's popularity in a world that is starved of this precious and sacred dimension in almost every aspect of life. It's reflective words to be thinking about at this time of year, I think.
The next day...
Doesn't do that.
Not holiday-themed whatsoever.
Does not deliver, having given you a childlike vision.
But I like that you're keeping the mix. I like that you're mixing it up and you're surprising us.
Yeah, we head into rather more dystopian territory for the 19th of December. That was the day in 1971 that the Stanley Kubrick film A Clockwork Orange was released. And the composer of the soundtrack to that is someone who I really think is badass. She is just incredible. The wonderful Wendy Carlos, born in 1939. And I was originally intrigued by Wendy Carlos in her life before she was Wendy. She was Walter Carlos. She was born in 1931. And in 1968, she released an extraordinary project called Switched on Bach, which was really Walter's mission at that point, to talk about how the fact that electronic music and the synthesizer could be as important and interesting a combination and an instrument, I suppose, as any regular classical instrument. So with the greatest reverence and respect for the original Bach material, Switched on Bach did something completely different. It gave it the real 20th century treatment, smashing the barriers between acoustic and synthesized sound and winning 3 Grammys in the process. It became, I think, the first platinum-selling classical album. It pretty much remains the most influential electronic classical music album of all time. So I absolutely loved what Carlos did with Bach. And then I also think she's an absolutely fantastic and evocative film composer. So I should say that in 1968, that same seminal year, she began transitioning and then came out as a transgender woman in a 1979 Playboy interview announcing, "I'm anxious to liberate myself." But let's hear the theme from A Clockwork Orange. Thank you. Rollicking is a great word for it. I love the fact that you can hear that here is a composer who is steeped in the classical tradition. And at some points in the score, she riffs directly on Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which is a core piece of classical music from the canon. And yet she's got such a grasp of narrative storytelling and how that would work for a 1970s movie that's very much a kind of dystopian and rather violent film. I think it's just an absolute testament to her musical imagination and her genius. And I love the fact that she said, you know, she really wanted electronic music to share the same musical values of the best of acoustic music performance, nuanced, rubato, expressive, plastic, and ever-changing, ever-shifting. And I think her music really proves that electronic music can definitely do all of those things and more.
I love the next one, Tchaikovsky and Ellington. Wow.
Yeah, Tchaikovsky, as you've maybe never heard him before. Let's give this a little spin and then I'll give you a little context. I wish listeners had the benefit of being able to see Alison doing a little bop in the studio here at WNYC.
I was thinking, oh, my holiday mix. I just found something new to put on it.
Isn't it perfect? I love this so much. There's a very witty thing about, I have it on LP, and the sleeve notes were written by Irving Townsend. It was released by Columbia in 1960. And when I was first, you know, rifling through a record shop and I picked this up, the opening words are, Duke Ellington and Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky met in Las Vegas while Duke's band was setting attendance records at the Riviera Hotel. And I did a kind of like, what? Duke Ellington and Tchaikovsky met in Vegas. And he had me for a minute. And of course, the whole thing is a spoof because Tchaikovsky had been dead for a full 6 years before Ellington was even born. And it was going to be another 6 years before the railroad town of Las Vegas was even established. But I loved that thought of Tchaikovsky and Ellington hanging out in Sin City, swapping musical ideas and comparing notes on their shared love of the suite, because Tchaikovsky wrote a lot in suite. So did Duke Ellington. And we think about Duke Ellington as being this absolute giant of American jazz, and of course he absolutely is that, but he was also fascinated by classical music, and his harmonic and his formal inventiveness make him so much more than just a jazz man. And I adore jazz, so that would be sufficient, that would be plenty if that was all he had done. But he also wrote oratorios and concertos and orchestral suites and symphonic tone poems and instrumental pieces and operas and ballads. And, you know, we never think about Duke Ellington, the classical composer, or we rarely do, but he absolutely deserves to be up there and considered that too. And I just love that he adored Tchaikovsky's music. And apparently he turned around and said of Tchaikovsky, that cat was it.
The name of the book is The Year of Wonder by Clemency Burton Hill. I swear it'll fit in a stocking. I know it will. Clemmy, thank you so much, and we'll see you on Christmas Eve.
See you Christmas Eve. Thanks, Allison.
When we come back, we're going to continue to talk jazz with Maxine Gordon. Her late husband was the jazz great Dexter Gordon. Maxine has just released a version of his biography that Dexter began working on but wasn't able to complete before his death. Maxine completed the project. It's called Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. Stay with all of it. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Maxine Gordon has spent a lifetime as an independent scholar and oral historian working with jazz musicians. In her book, Sophisticated Giant, she presents the legacy of her late husband, the beloved and celebrated bebop tenor sax player, Dexter Gordon. As one of the most influential modern jazz innovators, Dexter was known for his Oscar-nominated role in Round Midnight, among many other things. Let's listen to Dexter as he plays the song, Society Red. Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon, fulfills the promise Maxine made to her husband to complete his biography
Maxine Gordon, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much.
So you write that Dex would jot down his memories on these big legal pads. Do you know why he wanted to write his own biography?
Well, actually, in the beginning, he wanted to do it with James Baldwin. That was his idea, and he called him. He knew him. And Baldwin thought that was a good idea, but he said, I'm not well, so go ahead, write it yourself. And Baldwin died in December of that year. And then Dexter thought about doing it with somebody, and then he thought, no, I could write it. I could write it. And so we were living in Mexico, and he began. He began writing his autobiography in not exactly the way I do the book, but he had an idea.
It's interesting. We had the director of archives for the Louis Armstrong House.
Oh.
And, you know, Louis Armstrong.
Is that Ricky?
Yes, Ricky.
Oh, that's my guy. I love Ricky Riccardi. He's the best.
Of course you know Ricky Riccardi. What was I thinking?
No, but he's the best, isn't he?
He's so great. God. And he was saying that Louis Armstrong wrote down for, he used to say, for posterity, that he had a sense of his own place in history. Did Dexter have that sense of his own place?
I think he might have gotten it from being with Louis Armstrong. And also about writing letters, because Louis Armstrong traveled with a typewriter and wrote letters. And, you know, in the chapter on Louis Armstrong, he's very influenced by him. But not so much his personal idea about posterity, but about the musicians and the music. He thought, like, in a broader way about jazz and the people who didn't get the attention he felt they deserved.
It's great. In the book, there's passages that are Dexter's. And the one he wrote of Lewis, he said, working with Lewis was love, love, love. That was what it was all about. All love. He was just beautiful, always beautiful. It was just a gas being with him. He let me play all the time. He really dug me.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of people who were really important to Dexter and in his career development?
Oh, that's such a good question. Thank you. The first one would be Marshall Royal, who was with the Lionel Hampton Band and gave him his first job. And that relationship, Dexter said, I had a job before I could really play the saxophone. And he thought they would send him home every night. And he left high school. He was a senior to go on the road. So he always thanked Marshall Royal, and he got a chance to thank him at the Black Oscars. You probably read about the Black Oscars. So he thanked Count Basie, he thanked Lester Young. He was always thanking somebody. But if he had won the Oscar, which we know that Paul Newman won, he was going to thank one person, and that was Louis Armstrong.
Oh, wow.
You know, he said, instead of listing, you know, all the people like people do, he said, we must be grateful to Louis Armstrong for being the first to put this music out in the world.
One of the things you write, that Dexter wanted to tell the story of Black expats,
like
Jimmy Baldwin, a story about how America didn't necessarily embrace and pushed away creative Black people. Why was it important for him to talk about this topic?
Well, sometimes in jazz history, they would mention that he was 14 years living in Europe, 62 to 76, and they would kind of frame it as if it's the lost years, you know, but in fact, the years are not lost, that he worked all the time, much more than he would have worked had he been here. Plus, he felt, in a way, free of racism and the constraints of being in this country. But in another way, I mean, you're not free from the constraints just because you're living in Europe, but it is another approach. And also he had time to think and read and reflect. But at a certain point, he wanted to come back. So he made that move and came back, and it worked out well.
We're talking to Maxine Gordon about her book, Sophisticated Giant. Now, please correct me if I'm wrong from all the research. You went back to school.
Yes.
To study because you really wanted to do this in a scholarly way. And you really wanted to learn more. What were some of the things that you learned while you were in school that you were able to use to tell Dexter's story?
Well, the first thing is research method. So I was very fortunate, and I had a fellowship to NYU with Robin Kelly, and Robin Kelly is the foremost historian Well, one of the foremost historians on African-American history, and he wrote the book on Thelonious Monk, among other books. The greatest book is called Freedom Dreams, to me, than he wrote. However, he was the chair of history at NYU, and we had to learn method. So I didn't know how to do that, but I did. And African-American history and cultural history, because you can't really, to me, write about jazz without writing about Black cultural history. And so I wanted to be sure. I was always complaining about what wasn't in other books. And then I think it was Robin who said, well, you know, put it in your book. So, I learned the method, but I also learned, I mean, I had 6 years to read a lot of books.
It's interesting. You had to go through a peer review process at one point.
Yes, and it's an academic press.
And one of your peers didn't quite understand.
Oh, yeah, you read that interview, right?
Didn't quite understand. Uh-huh. Talk to me about that process of working with your editor and, you know, sticking by your guns and saying, yeah, this is the way it needs to be. It's not just going to be a timeline, tick, 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 tick.
Right. Well, when it first went out, peer review, I'm not sure what that means because, you know, are they really our peers? But anyway, when it first went out, the first reader didn't like I talk about Dexter's family history. He didn't like the part about political economy where I talk about contracts and money and publishing. He didn't think I needed that. He wanted more personal information about me and Dexter. And, you know, it's not that kind of book. And so what I said was I didn't think he was the right reader. And they agreed. So that worked out. And then the next person was Scott DeVoe, who revealed who he was. You know, sometimes they're anonymous. They can be, but he revealed himself, and he's a big scholar on bebop. He wrote the history of bebop, so that was great.
It's interesting in listening to you describe the way you wrote this book. Who did you want to read this book, and who do you think could really benefit from reading this book?
I really wanted people who didn't know who Dexter Gordon was.
So not just fans.
No, the fans, we know they're going to read, and we have what we call the jazz police, and they... No insult, but they will find what's not there that they wanted there, and they know everything, and they'll find a mistake. I did have a mistake about George Gershwin.
Oh, it happens.
But sorry. But I wanted people, first of all, there are people who love the film Round Midnight who didn't know who Dexter was. They're film people, French film, Bertrand Tavernier people. I wanted people who never heard of him but were curious, and people maybe who were interested in jazz but I don't want them to feel excluded. You know, there's sometimes what happens around jazz is because you have the inside group that people feel like they don't know enough. And I remember when we were kids and we were like, thought we were like the jazz kids, people were like mean to us because, you know, you don't know anything. And, you know, but we stayed in there, and I just want people to know you can love this music without being an authority.
The name of the book is Sophisticated Giant. We're speaking with Maxine Gordon, its author. Sophisticated Giant, it's a great title because he was 6 foot
Five. Yeah, or six, depending on who's measuring.
It's so interesting. Do you think that really had any sort of impact on his career? I know that's an odd question, but I'm just...
No, it's not an odd question. Yeah, definitely. He said, he used to make a joke, there are two tenor players who are great, who are short. They're shorter than me. I'm 5'3". Or maybe I'm less than 5'3 now. But anyway, there are two great tenor players, and he often played with them. So you can imagine, you know, it's like 5'2" and 6'6". And he'd say, you know, you'd make more money and be more famous if you were taller. And everybody would laugh. But really, he said it had a lot to... He felt that had given him more opportunities than some people. And he always thought people played better. There were always... He was like, oh, my God, that guy, look out for him. He plays better than me. And I was like, you play pretty good.
Pretty good. Pretty
and
well.
And he'd be like, not good enough. And so that was his way of thinking.
Something that's interesting is that, you know, when he wrote down his notes, there was a certain period he didn't want to put in. Uh-huh. And you, as the scholar, you were even before you wrote this book, said you have to put in the tough stuff, too.
Right.
Why?
Well, you know, first of all, I talk about it in the book, we had a discussion, or difference about doing an outline. He thought an outline was so corny, so linear, so, you know, no. But I won that argument, which is unusual. And then he went from 1948 to 1960, and he was leaving out the entire decade. And after arguing, he said, if you want it in the book, you have to write it yourself. And then there was never any mention of that period. But a friend of his who lived through that period with him said, you have to put it in the book. Yeah. And I always wanted to, but it took a lot of research.
Maxine Gordon will be discussing her book tomorrow at the 92nd Street Y at noon and in Newark, New Jersey on December 19th with Wayne Winborn, director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Clements Place. That is 6 p.m. We'll also put it on our Twitter account so you can find out more information. Maxine Gordon, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me. I love your show. Love it.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC.